We on? Now then, Ray Winston here. The real one. Close enough. Doing a new podcast with me mate Tony. Soprano, that is.
Oh, how you doing?
Talking all the big stuff. Birds, scraps, films.
And of course, men's mental health. With studio guests such as arch feminist and top broad Deborah Francis White and disgraced scumbag comedian Dapper Laughs.
Something for everyone. We're trying to be better men, ain't we, Tone?
That's right. We're bad boys done good.
Available on YouTube and to download on all good audio platforms. Go on, get off your hands, you dopey c***.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Insane in the Membrane.
Insane in the Membrane.
But before we get into it, over on my other podcast, Insane in the Fembrane, I'm talking to Soho Radio host Kelly Ford. It was a great chat. We really covered a lot of ground. I think you're going to enjoy this one. So search it up on your podcast app, Insane in the Fembrane. You won't regret it. Also, I'm going to give a shout out to the 5-star reviewers that have been on the Apple podcast there. Thank you guys. Loads, so many. I didn't realize. I'm so shit at looking. I'm rubbish. It's me. I'm crap at admin. Brilliant. And if anyone, I have seen someone's left us a 1-star review, and whoever that was, you're probably not listening to this. You're probably long gone, but fuck yourselves. But you guys, the 5-star reviewers. So we've got Mooch Your Mama. Thank you very much, Mooch. We've got Mr. Madrigal. Mr. Madrigal, thank you very much, mate. And we've got Hell's Marsh. Hell's Marsh, thank you for that. Really lovely. Wonderful. We've got Pandore 718. Thank you for that. Lucy from England. Again, thank you very much for your 5-star review. And Karma Podcast. Thank you. Honestly, there's loads. I'm going to be reading out a few of these every week just to catch up. I didn't realise. I'm so shit. Thank you. This is so nice, especially the way things are at the minute. You just need this. I need this little bit of a boost. Thank you very much. Okay, so let's get on with the episode. This week, I was joined by the brilliant poet, Patrick Jones. Hails from Wales. I'm going to say this. He's such a sweet man. Every guest, and I say this all the time, and I mean it from the bottom of my heart, every guest is brilliant. And every week I'm like, oh, is it going to be a duff one? Is it going to be a duff one? And there never is. I've been very lucky. Patrick Jones is a diamond. What a lovely, lovely man. And you'll hear in a moment what I'm talking about. Such a beautiful man. There'll be some crackles and things like that, because obviously we're doing this remotely. So sometimes our connections aren't great. And so, you know, so just bear with us, because it's well worth listening. Ignore the crackles, because what happens in between is so beautiful. And there'll be a link to Patrick's website in the release notes, in the podcast notes. You'll be able to click on his stuff. And please listen to the end, because Patrick gave us a wonderful poem at the end. He's such a beautiful man. And yeah, and Patrick is the elder brother of Nicky Wire from Manic Street Preachers, which we talked on a bit much later on in the episode, because I didn't really want it to be about that. I wanted it to be about Patrick, because Patrick's work is beautiful and stands alone, you know, and that's why I wanted it to come on. So thank you, Patrick. And I think you'll get a lot out of this. He's a very beautiful man. As I say, listen to the end, because it's really nice. So without further ado, Patrick Jones.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
I tell you what really made me smile. You've spent a lot of time in Blackwood, and yeah. I've got a soft spot for Blackwood.
Why is that?
Well, when I started in comedy, is where I did some of my first gigs at the Miners Institute.
Did you?
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. And
go down well?
Yeah, actually, right? Went really well. What was the other one? Blen Gaddell.
Is it? Oh yes. That's even further into the wilds. It's the end of the valley, isn't
yes.
it? Up there.
It was, yeah. It was actually, yeah. When I looked out of the B&B bedroom, you could see the end of the road.
It stopped.
Yeah, it just stopped.
So did you have a tour of South Wales?
We went to, yes, my first, we went to, where did we go? Blen Gaddell. Blackwood as well. Blackwood, I've been to a couple of times. I had interesting experience in Blackwood. There's a. I don't know if it's still there. I can't remember what it was called. This pub, not the Propeller, something like that. Something in repeat, and it was a pub in the daytime, and then it became a club in the night, or kind of a nightclubby thing. And when we got
Porters?
What was it? Sorry, what was it?
Porters.
Yes, I think it's Porters.
Right, okay, yeah.
Yes, yeah. Propeller. I don't know what that is.
Propeller, yeah. Look.
Just go for
it.
But there was, I remember we were talking to the landlord, and as I'm talking to him, I looked on the back shelves, and there were where crisps and peanuts and things should be, pregnancy test kits.
Oh, really?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I like this place.
Be prepared in Blackwood. Yeah.
But you've,
that's interesting.
It was a great, but you spent a lot of time there.
Well, that's where I grew up. Yes, obviously, I live about 5 miles. I have travelled in between. I haven't just gone 5 miles. But that's where I grew up, Blackwood. You know, in the valleys in the '70s. Yeah, happy times, really. I had to laugh as well. Sorry to stalk you, but I enjoyed one of your stand-ups when you were talking about, you know, I'm a bit older than you, so I go back even further. But I, you know, that idea of when you were young and our parents, you're right. You know, today I got 3 sons and I'm always saying, oh, well done, you know, sign up for this. Oh, I'll send you this link. But in my day, it was like, go off and play all day, play cricket.
Just out, wasn't it?
Out.
Just out.
Yes.
And it,
so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but that so you yeah you're about more yeah a little bit.
I'm 55, so I'm fucking ancient.
Yeah. I really love Wales, and I used to love the fact that with the male voice choirs, you've got these burly lads that would be down the mines all day, dealing with whatever they're dealing with, and then they'd come up and do these, and there was an elegance to it.
Yes,
and I love that.
Yeah.
And it seems
and a
to
dignity.
Like, yeah. Yes.
A deep dignity to what they were doing. Yeah.
Yes.
I agree. Yeah. Obviously, all cancelled at the moment and all, maybe virtually, because maybe they're doing it virtually. But it's a great tradition of singing, you know, coming, you know, the Blackwood Miners Institute where you played, obviously, and 100 years ago, the miners built that, paying a penny a week type of thing, you know.
Oh, really?
It's just a, yeah, you know, those days, there's something beautiful about them compared to today where we're all chasing our next fix type of thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's interesting. And have you been up to North Wales and West Wales, or is it just Blackwood and Blengarry?
Yeah, that was it. Well, I've been to Bangor and I've been to Llandudno. I've been around. My favourite drive is to go, I think it's the A5 that goes down past down that coastline.
Oh yes,
it's stunning.
And you go through the big tunnel and then you come out. Yes, yeah, it's a beautiful coast up there. Yeah, North Wales. Yeah, it's different to the South Wales coast. It's just very rugged. It's like Cornwall. That sort of ruggedness and barrenness and broken beauty. So that's interesting. I also liked the bit you said about your accent, where you said your accent is like where everyone on a stag night sounds like. But so where did you grow up?
I grew up in sort of Kent, southeast London, that area.
Okay.
Which is why I've got this exotic accent, and this is why. But people, and I was looking into you, and I imagine you might have had a similar thing. People that are seen as sort of work, you know, people that are working class. I don't remember. People never ask me about books and what I've read, even though I read all the time. And and you must have. It must have been a similar thing for you, like, you know, getting into poetry.
Yeah,
and things like that.
It's like dialect discrimination almost. Yeah, you're right. It's very coming from the valleys. Even though we got a great history of poets and artists. I was thinking about this the other day, and it was a sense that, you know, people looked down on me because I was writing poetry. They thought I was effeminate. They thought I was dodging work. When I discovered writing, and obviously I got a younger brother, you probably come across him, and same with him when he started writing the songs. People were sort of, although music was a little bit more tolerated because it's like, oh, it's a bit cooler, you know. But even so, you know, the way they used to dress, they were quite sort of frowned upon in a way as well from that working class. As if it wasn't for us, as if we were meant to go into the pot noodle factory, as if we sort of thing. Yeah, and it's hopefully that's changed a bit now when you look around at the poets, perhaps, and writers who are making it, maybe, I don't know, or comedians. Do you think there's more, it's more inclusive?
I think so. Things are definitely changing. It's more acceptable. But, yeah, I mean, you made great strides to make those changes. I saw, you started the literacy group at the
Oh, you've been on Wikipedia.
Yeah. Yes, I've had a proper look into you. I've been there, so I'm aware of the environment that you would have grown up in, and it would have been, like you say, you and your brother doing things that weren't necessarily. I grew up in a small town on the edge of London, and even then, you did your best not to stand out too much because you would have got your head kicked in, and true. So I kept all anything I did. Sort of mute. If I was like going to see bands, I wouldn't tell anybody. I'd slide off and do it. I'd go into London and I wouldn't really tell anybody. And I didn't tell anyone about books that I'd read. And I kept it because I didn't want to get it. I would have been beaten up because of the. I think it's a fear thing, isn't it? Rather than they're scared of it.
Yeah. So do you think it's more of a male trait? Do you think if we were females growing up, we would have had a different acceptance, or do you think there's that peer pressure for males perhaps not to show that side of us as well?
I think there was a lot of that growing up, yeah. And I think it would have been the same for women in certain respects as well. Yeah. I can't speak for women, but I think anybody that did anything that was against the, because it was always about get a job, then you're going to meet someone, you're going to meet a woman, don't you be messing around. Yeah. And then you're going to have kids and then you're going to die and that's your life. And anyone who did anything against that was seen as weird.
I agree, I remember poetry in school and I had this vision that it was just for like public school, people who've been to public school, go to Eton, Oxford, Cambridge, as if you were supposed to wear a cape when you read poetry,
sit under the stairs with candlelight.
So, And it was music in a way. You know, I wasn't some child protege reading voraciously all the time. You know, I did love my music, the tail end of post-punk, and then it was, you know, heavy rock, you know, the old metal scene. It just opened up my horizons, really. It guided me into books and writers in a way, from The Clash, you know, Clash with Allen Ginsberg, etc. So music was the catalyst, and then I found my... I wasn't very good at playing the guitar, so I found my way with words, really. Yeah.
I've said that before. I said this on something else, that it was music that taught me about other cultures and I found out about people that were gay. I found out about people. I found out about oppression, and I found out about writers, and I found out about all manner of stuff. All from music.
Yeah. And it's very accessible.
Absolutely. Yes. And it was how, because school, I didn't do very well at school, but I always had I learned more from the albums that I was buying. Like you've just said, it's.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so were you at the tail end of vinyl? Would you buy vinyl or were you more cassette or CDs by your time?
I was at the tail end of vinyl.
Vinyl, yeah.
So it would have been, so I came of age in late 80s, early 90s.
Right, yeah, so more CDs. And
yeah, it was just getting into CDs. I've gone back to vinyl recently, and what a time I'm having. It's wonderful. My dad has just given me his record collection from back when so all the records that I grew up with, the very records that taught me all these things, I now have in my possession. And it's wonderful.
Great.
Yeah.
I only ask about vinyl because, you know, it used to be quite a holy thing, buying a vinyl, opening up, reading the lyrics. You know, I do sound like some old school.
It's beautiful.
It's true, isn't it?
Yeah.
It was a work of art.
It really was, wasn't it? From cover to final song, everything was thought about, you know, and I miss those days that, you know, the hunt, you could hunt for things. And, you know, or somebody told you about a book and it's out of print now. And you're like, right. And you just spend hours trying to find it.
Yeah, exactly. And,
like you said, I've looked at Wikipedia. I've been busy. You've been busy. I mean, you have been, what a career you've had. What a life.
Oh, I don't know. Thank you. But I've been around a while. So hopefully I've got a bit of history of, you know, I suppose I started writing in about, oh God, 84, 85, which does sound really, really black and white days, as my kids say. I didn't go freelance or, you know, self-employed writer till 19, terrible with my dates, you know, that's a bad sign. Probably about before, I had my first play in 99, so about 97 I went self-employed. So since then I've just been, battling away, and I go wherever words take me, you know. As I got older, I had this sort of, you know, I think if I'm doing a writing workshop in a nursing home in Blangarroo, I have the same type of passion and feeling, I believe, in my heart, that if I'm doing a poetry reading or if I've, you know, worked with, I recently had an album out with James Bradfield, you know,
which is quite exciting
for us poets. So my point is, I think I feel I'm quite lucky to do, you know, similar to yourself, perhaps you feel lucky to what we are doing. So if I'm doing that reading workshop with five elderly ladies who are nodding off to sleep, I still give it my all. And I really believe that's the way I think you... I never want to walk in like, oh, blasé, here's a 100 quid paycheck. Just, you know, it's like, no, you've got to work hard. So that's my ethos.
Oh, you're right.
Chip on my shoulder, working class.
That's exactly what it is, isn't it? It's that chip on the shoulder that pushes us on.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I see this, everything I do that isn't me driving a van or, you know, working in a factory or whatever, I see this as a privilege.
Yeah.
And the fact that I can have this conversation with you now, I feel blessed and lucky that I've been able to do this. I get to meet wonderful people like yourself. So you started in the early 80s. So it would have been, so back then we had Red Wedge and we had a lot of people were
yeah.
protesting things. There were that started to sort of that was happening in the early 80s, and you, I see you were sort of part of that, not Red Wedge, but you were part. You were doing stuff.
I was quite young then, so I suppose I was more being inspired by the likes of Billy Bragg, Paul Weller doing stuff post the Jam.
Yeah,
and I went to university. You know, I was first in my family to go to Swansea University. And I remember having a grant. I literally had money every week. It was just, you know, looking now at my son's 20 grand in debt from a university education. When I went to Swansea University, and that's when literature and politics, you know, your mind just, you know, it broadens. You suddenly see there's a big world out there. There's lots of ideas and there's a lot of injustice and things. And so 84, 85, it started. And then I went to America because I... Part of my course, what a year in America. I mean, how lucky was that? American studies, it's very good for a job career.
Just so off you go.
So I spent a year in America, which was, again, from a lad in the valleys. When I look back, I think, oh, my God, that was just a...
That must have been mind-blowing for you.
It was, it was. And then I came back and I struggled to settle back in Wales in a way. And so then I just worked... got some more money and then went back to America to write this great Welsh-American Jack Kerouac type of novel, which never materialised. But I lived there then for 3 years and just worked and wrote and I got married.
Amazing. What?
Didn't last too long.
Where in America were you?
Yeah, I went to university in Tennessee, which was quite redneck in those days. It was quite, you know... But it, you know, and then I came back, and when I finished my degree in Swansea, I went back to Chicago, which was again that was an amazing experience. And I there were a lot of poetry slams and stand up type of things.
Improv comes, the improv groups.
Yeah, exactly. That sort of culture, which was a great apprenticeship to get up and just. Oh, I think I've lost you there.
No, hello. You all right?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Perhaps it's just my ears ringing, my tinnitus. Sorry.
I think I've got a bit of that sometimes. I've stood next to the speakers in gigs far too often.
It's that humming. It just doesn't go away when you get older.
No.
Sorry. You didn't mean to go. But so, Chicago. And then I said I was married, like I said, but it was for a green card, in all honesty, even though we did love each other. We lived together. We had two cats and luckily no children at that time. And then I had a spine injury on my disc and I had to have an operation. Luckily, my wife then had insurance. Mm. And but when I came out and had the operation, she announced that she'd been having an affair, which really... it was like,
God.
You could have waited till my back was a bit better because it was a pretty... So I was laid up and I really struggled then. So I stayed a few months and I thought, oh, fuck it. I it's quite hard now. Everything's felt very temporary in America then. And I came back. So basically I came back in 92. So to the valleys with 20 quid in my pocket and two suitcases starting again. So,
oh, wow.
But that's life, isn't
it?
It is,
yeah. But this is this is where you get all your stories from, isn't it?
Yeah,
I know Doug Stanhope, the comedian, said that. You know, there was a story of him and Dane Cook doing a gig, and Dane Cook went back to his room to write material and do some stuff. And Doug was like, no, go out. You go out into some shitty bar somewhere and you meet all these weird and wonderful people.
Yeah. Exactly. I've always enjoyed just observing life and just watching and, like I said, meeting these, you know, different people who... You know, we've all got great stories to tell. We've all got, you know. So, that's just a brief synopsis of that's how it started, I suppose. And then I came back in 92 and just, and then I started teaching. It was a great, luckily, part-time job teaching literacy to adults, which was really, you know, interesting work. And I felt I was doing something with words. Mm. You know, you had adults who had missed out in school, who were dyslexic, et cetera. And, it was great. It was a night class in the old days of a good night class. Have a cup of tea after an hour and a good chat. It was a beautiful.
Sounds great.
It was a good time. So, and then I worked in the library because then I had got involved with the mother of two of my children and. She became pregnant with my eldest son, and so I had to get a real job then, obviously, to pay we had to get a mortgage. And I worked in a library, which was, it sounds romantic, but it was like being a labourer, really, on a building site. You know, people just telling you, just put those books back. But I want to write. I was like, I was a bit naive, perhaps. And then I, But anyway, and then, yeah, I just kept on writing, and then I wrote a play and just sent it off. That's when it really started, because you can't survive off poetry unless you're dead, really, I think,
in all honesty. What a great line.
Yeah. But I just love words, you know, probably like yourself. You're not just a comedian. You obviously do this sort of work and talk to people, and it's about the voice, the connections, the stories.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I just love words, and a play then happened in about 98, 99, and that's then I went freelance roughly then. So yeah, that's how it all went. So I can qualify for SUNY. Rishi Sunak. Is 40% self-employed thing now? Oh well, that's yeah.
I was at 40% now.
It's gone up to 40 today. Woo! Yeah, it went from 80 to 20. I think they had it all planned, basically. Anyway,
yeah,
so it's like that.
Did.
It's like a call out bluff. But so that's where I've been really. And then in between those 20 years, which again, that's worrying, because I think in 20 years' time, Christ, I'll be 75. That'll be it. I'll be gone. I'll be, you know. So. 20 years in that span, you know, plays, poetry. I love working with music, and I've done spoken word albums with musicians, and a lot of work out there in the community, which to me is, it's just as important and soul galvanizing as writing a poem. You know, working out there with people, perhaps who, again, like us, always thought poetry was for someone else, but it's like, no. So yeah. I see myself as a bit of like, spreading the gospel of poetry, really.
But it needs that. Yes. It needs people like you.
It does.
To show people. Well, you know, especially like you say, in the environment we grew up in, and it was seen, you know, like, I was lucky that my dad, there was literature everywhere. My dad was a very big reader, and so there were books everywhere. So even though I didn't necessarily read them, I know the names of them, and Oblomov and things like that. I was like, what's that? What is Oblomov? You know, things like that, you know. So. And it's only until later on I'm like, I remember that. What was that about? And so, yeah. So I was very lucky. Whereas some people don't have that, and so they have a passion for it. They have a passion for words,
yeah.
And things.
And sad to say, I don't think schools, particularly now, you know, sort of inspire people to be creative. I really don't. I don't think you might get a top set in English, etc. But it's not about that. It's about It's not studying a poem. It's writing it, being creative, having that imagination, music, art, drama. And I go into schools a lot, and it's quite depressing. And I know a lot of teachers, that they're hemmed in by the curriculum and by tick boxes.
Yeah.
But sometimes you go and you just know that they're just trotting out formula, you know. It's almost like a maths lesson. So what did your dad do, you know, work-wise?
Well, he was a civil servant.
Right.
Yeah, right. But I think it's the same as you. He went to art school. He studied art. He's a really good painter, and really loved his poetry and all sorts. But then he met my mum, and then my mum became pregnant with me, and so he went and got a proper job, and he went and worked he was customs and excise that went on to be HMRC.
But still kept all that creative
he did. Yeah. So I was very lucky in that respect.
Yeah.
And my sons have taken that on as well. My eldest is a dancer, and my youngest has just been taken. He's just gone on to BIM in Bristol.
He's a musician then.
Yeah, he's a drummer. So
fantastic.
So I'm very. So that's because because of what I was doing. They've kind of gone, oh yeah, there is another way. You know, and that's what you're doing. You're shining a light on the fact that. There is something else out there, and you're allowed to explore it.
Totally, that's right. And it's that, because we always feel it's not for us, or we're not allowed. You're right. Mm. It's for us to be passive puppets. Sometimes it feels, you know. So it's my favorite little thing I do in the workshop, particularly with the elderly groups. I just ask people, because they say, "Oh, I can never write a poem," and I say, "Okay," I say, "What is your favorite? If you could take one smell to a desert island, what would it be and why?" And you're probably thinking now, "What's yours?" Which is great. You could tell me now. And what happens then? It's amazing, because they'll start saying, "Oh, it's the smell of a wood fire," say, for example. And then I say, and what does that remind you of? And then suddenly we have this story, and you can see their eyes think, yeah, I am a poet. I've just written something because it's, you know, it's such a simple little trigger. And everyone creates poems about their favourite smell. And I've been moved to tears sometimes because, wow. Oh, you know. So what's your favourite smell? What would you take to a desert island? Put you on the spot.
Do you know what? Fresh baked bread.
Oh, OK. And why is that special?
I think, do you know what? It's because where I grew up, my mum used to work in the bread factory, Tip Top Bakery, which is down near where we lived. And so when we'd go and play down by the river, you could smell the bread.
All day.
Yeah, just out. And I think that's why you could smell the bread while we were in the river fishing and chucking things around. And it reminds me of that. Yeah.
And then your mum would be working there.
Yeah. And she'd bring bread and cakes home, and and so it reminds me of that, very evocative of
being, it's his smell.
Yeah,
you're right. So smell, it is. Apparently, I think it's one of our last senses to leave us at the end.
Is,
you know,
it really?
With the smell. So I say that example just because how simple. Okay, but that's not going to change the world, and you know, it's poetry. We hope it can do, but it gives people a voice, and suddenly they've written something, and they can show that to someone, and. Yeah, so, and I really miss that at the moment because you can't obviously have those face-to-face contacts in nursing homes and prisons and care homes, hospitals, you know. Really miss it. It's,
a lot of people have said that. It's the human connection that we're all missing. That fact that we can't just, even on a small, on a basic level, we can't just wander into a shop and say hello and connect with each other. And you obviously care, and you love people.
Well, that not comes all across. People. I'm a bit of a recluse, but it's when you see that spark of someone who's just perhaps. You obviously got the good people and the people who are really, you know, kind and caring and been through a lot. And then you've got the people perhaps who... You learn to understand why they may be a little bit defensive or a bit angry as well as we get older, you know. So, I like unleashing that sort of sense of poetry and creation with them if I can. And I'm not saying that, you know, it's not for everyone, but with that sense of people, I am, but I do struggle a bit with people sometimes.
Really?
I don't know about you, but in this time, I've also become a bit, as we said, a bit apprehensive because you feel people, you know, say you're out for a walk and someone is running towards you and they'll go on the other side of the road then because of, you know, the situation. And it's I think we're all just a bit nervous as well of saying the wrong thing, doing the wrong thing, touching the wrong item or in the shop. So I wandered off the tangents.
Not at all. This can go anywhere you want it to go. The whole space is yours, Patrick, and it can go wherever you want to go.
Okay.
It's absolutely
fine. I've just been honest that I do struggle a bit people-wise because I'm not the best speaker, really. You know, I can write poetry, but I struggle. I was a little bit apprehensive because I thought when Paul said, you know, usually podcasts, you know, 20 minutes or something, or they try and get rid of you in 10. I remember I did something the other day. I said, oh, how long did you want me? They said, 5 minutes. And you think, fucking hell, I can't really say much in 5 minutes. but an hour and a half, I was like, oh, my God, I'm going to bore people.
No, not at all.
But I did listen to some of the ones on Spotify, and I did like the style of it. It's quite sort of, it flows.
It's loose, there's no pressure, and it goes wherever you want it to go, like I said, and we talk about whatever you want. And if there is something that you don't want to go out, we can edit that. You have complete control over this.
Yeah, I'm fine.
And it's all good. Okay. So you mentioned being a bit of a recluse, and is that just because? I suppose that you don't really. That just happens, I guess.
Yeah, maybe. And I
completely understand why as well. With things are the way they are, I felt like that. Kind of. Do I want to go out?
Shutting away a bit.
Yeah, a bit
burnt out from everything as well. I used to watch the news, you know, 3 times a day, and it's like, oh, I can't take any more of it. So I just. But even before this, really, I'm quite a quiet sort of person, and just enjoy, crafting those worlds with words, really. But it's also then, because I got divorced 4 years ago now, my wife, another one, another
I'm sorry to hear that.
Another affair.
What?
Yeah, I know. I must be me. I must be too soft, or I don't know. Maybe
what?
It's me.
There must be a. Yeah, I don't. Yes. Oh, my. I'm mate. So, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've had a bit of bad luck, but,
shit.
But that's life. You know, that is life. And we've been. It's okay. I don't mind talking about it. It's quite cathartic. And I recently wrote a funny poem about it, which I'm going to tell you about because I, you know, comedy wise, you might think I was a bit all heavy, but I'm not. I do love a good laugh. But I haven't been able to write, you know, humorously about it. It was quite dark stuff because we'd been together 15 years and, you know, had a child together who's now 18 and a great lad. And, yeah, the way it ended, it was quite, you know, basically, it was a bit of a serial adulterer, shall I say. So, but one funny story, which I can now sort of laugh about, is that she told me that with this one person that she actually, they had sex. I can say that, obviously.
Okay.
It's hard. I almost prickle when I say it.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was at a night of, it was at some place of leisure thing or whatever, where there was a Gary Barlow impersonator tribute act. So that may not be funny to some people, but to me, because, anyway, so I had this vision, you know, because now I can smile about it with that distance, of this Gary Barlow-esque person, you know, spouting off all his songs, and then in some dark, dingy alleyway, here's my wife, and I went up to pick her up that night as well.
Oh, Patrick.
I know. I can smile. So I wrote a poem, and I had to Google all of Gary Barlow's fucking songs, which is quite a depressing thing. So I carved this poem out of Gary Barlow song titles, and it felt quite good in a way. I thought, so I don't know if that's comedy, but it felt quite cathartic. Sorry.
No.
That was quite good sharing that.
Mate, I can't. You obviously, of course, that hurts to talk about. And, and you're not going to find a humour in that for ages.
For a while, but I do now. It's strange how time bandages those moments somehow. Mm. Yeah. I don't know if you, I think you've mentioned that you had been married and got divorced.
Yes.
How did you cope mind-wise?
I think admitting that it was probably me that fucked it up.
All right.
Made it feel better. Okay. And it only because I hadn't dealt with a lot of stuff. And I kind of, she took the brunt of it. I didn't even know that that's what it was. I just was this, I didn't realise how difficult I had been until afterwards. And I kind of went, oh, shit. Because at the time it was like, oh, it's her. She's not doing this and she's not doing that and blah, 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 blah. But she was brilliant. She's a wonderful woman. And and I think, I got my, it got me, by admitting that it was my fault, that helped me. And then I could, then I could do something about it. And we've spoken since. I spoke to her last week.
Yeah.
And we're still on good terms. It's very good. But.
Yeah,
but I didn't have to deal with that you've dealt with.
It was quite de-emasculating, I suppose. Mm. There's a sense of, I'm not good enough, or I'm not handsome enough, or fit enough, or etc. There was obviously that comes into it.
Course,
as a woman
yeah.
would feel defeminized when a man has an affair, sleeps with someone else. So, there was a lot of that to deal with, and it took me a time. And then my mother became ill with leukemia, and we were a very close family, and my mum then passed away at 12 months after being diagnosed with leukemia.
Oh, wow.
Leaving my dad, who we looked after, my dad, because they've been together 63 years, you know, that generation.
Wow.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
But you know, the life had gone out of him. It was so sad because his love had gone of life, but we supported my dad as best we could and still had some beautiful moments. But then he beat bladder cancer, ironically, thumbs up my dad, really. Beat bladder cancer, you know, didn't talk about it, just got on with it.
Wow.
And then 2 months after that, then he had a heart attack and died, and I found him in bed, and it was, So it's been a tough three and a half, four years. But in a way, you just got to keep going through it for your own sanity and for your children and to be strong.
Yes.
But I have grieved as well. I've tried to... it's no good bottling up, but as you've talked about by facing up to things in different ways, we both have you know, I couldn't be in denial about loss of my marriage, about loss of my parents, etc. You just got to face it sometimes head on.
Yes.
Sorry, this has got a bit heavy.
But it's fine, Patrick.
You talk about mental health a lot with men. I think we do need to talk about these things, which I think we are more so, you know, generally.
I think so. Especially older people like us, the older generation that were told.
Yeah.
Keep it, you know, you don't really
keep it in.
You keep it in, you know, you're a man, you've got to push that shit down.
Yes.
And I think that's now why a lot of men of our age have problems now. You know, they're angry and resentful, and you know, because they haven't spoken about these things. And especially, I mean, that I can't imagine what that must have been like discovering your dad.
It
must have been awful for you.
It was the only saving grace is that my dad was a very probably similar generation, a bit older perhaps than your dad, you know, that very independent, very resourceful. Everything had masking tape on it. He would buy something new, you know, and he was very resourceful. So, and he died in his own house. He had no debts. And in a way, I thought perhaps, and I do get a bit emotional about this, but he kept a diary, and his last words that he wrote was to my mum, and he said, "Night, my love." And that was his last fucking word. So that's a poet, isn't it? You know,
isn't it beautiful? Yeah.
I thought, if you go to bed and you've written that, even though your love isn't with you, and you don't wake up, maybe, you know, he was 84. So I'm not trying to, like, you know, look on the bright side of life. I'm just trying to be realistic and think in a way. If there's a way to go, maybe that. He had a heart attack, he didn't know about it. So, there we are. Oh. So, yes. But, it was a funny sort of story about it. About that day before, again, I talk about being very practical. I'm not that practical, but I'll have a go. And I had a leak on the roof, but I had to. It was something to do with the boiler and the flue, which I don't even know what a flue is, but and British Gas. I'd been trying to get in touch with them, and they finally came on that morning. And I was going to go and meet up my dad, cook him dinner, as I did. So British Gas came, and you know, I was so fucking happy to be able to go and tell him, "Dad, British Gas come. They've sorted out the flue and all that." Because he would have loved that. He would have been, you know. And then I went up, and that moment where the curtains were still drawn, which is, he would never have done that, you know. So you try to look at it in that wholeness. And again, in his diary entry, he had mentioned about British Gas going up the next morning. So, you know, it's life. It's, that. So there we are. Anyway, fucking hell, this is hard work. This is quite deep, man.
It's good. It's beautiful. And what people will listen to this it's just the way that you talk about it. You've got a really nice way of... There's a joy in what you're talking about, even though it's a sad subject. You've found the joy in it. And that's... that's the other thing with people. When people hear the word poetry, they just go, it's just sad and it's this and it's that. But it's not all sad. A lot of it's beautiful.
I think we also, you know, we turn to poetry at those times. And as you said, it's beautiful that it you know, we find comfort in poetry, don't we? And humanity and connection, and and there's some beautiful poets. There's a lot of poets as well, man, which I really detest, and really, you know, they write for other poets. You know that type of poetry So I'm, you know, but sorry, I don't want to sound too gloomy about poetry, but when you find a poem, I find that, you know, it can say something in like two lines that. You know, I really believe it can save you, or it will. Those two lines will stay with you, you know, forever, which is quite magical, really. Whereas a novel, you know, it could take a whole novel to say that same type of, you know, poets really, a bit like comedy in a way. You know, a great observation or something can really, it'll really stay with you forever. Or a great line of comedy, I think. You know,
exactly. We sort of cut through to the juice. We get to the nitty gritty of it all, and we go, that's the bit you want to see. Yeah, all the rest of it's fine, but that at the core.
It's hard. I couldn't do stand up like you said. I think done poetry, of course, but stand up is even, I feel you even more naked in a way.
Oh, for sure. And it's the one art form that that people can give you an immediate review. And if you fuck up their night because you, in their eyes, have been shit, they will let you know. They will let you know.
Yeah.
You fucked up my night. And you're like, I just had a bad day at the office. I'm really sorry. You know, this normally works. I don't know what happened. They will go at you. And it is, I feel more comfortable in the time I'm on stage than I do the rest of the time. And I think,
really?
Yeah, and it's not even about, it's not about attention, and it's not about, I think it's because for the 20 minutes or the hour that I'm on stage, I'm not worrying about anything else. I'm not worrying about the government. I'm not worrying about the virus. I'm not worried about bills. I'm just in this bubble of just other, it's not reality. And I think that's why I really enjoy it. And seeing people laughing at things I've said gives me such a buzz. And I think,
I suppose it's similar to like a painter or musician, you know, playing a guitar. It's that flow, I suppose. That's your flow, isn't it, as well? You just, you know, even though it's a risk, as you said, people can look at you and think, this is not funny. You know, it's a risk putting yourself out there. But like you said,
it's happened as well.
Space.
It's happened as well. Oh, God. Yeah. When just someone's just staring at you and you're like, oh, God. Yeah. The rest of the room could be falling around laughing, but this one person is glaring.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ooh, yeah.
And that's the one you'll remember.
Yeah, forever. But have you done spoken word? Have you done?
I do a lot of poetry. I spoken word, sometimes it's a lot of, I love spoken word, but sometimes it's almost like the style over the content. Sometimes, that's my own personal view. I came from more trying to, I suppose I just enjoy performing my own poetry, you know, what it is, and just, I don't have any gimmicks or anything, you know, but I try and present it so it connects with people. Obviously, I think that's the art of a spoken word. So it connects, it touches, it moves, you know. So I have, and I've done it. I enjoy it with music, which adds another dimension to it, you know, which can confuse people because people think this, it's not singing, so it's not a song, but it's not just basic poetry as well.
Yeah.
But other people really relate to it because if like music we talked about, it gives you another way in to poetry if it's got music speaking. Yeah, it's not new, you know. Patti Smith, Velvet Underground, I suppose, almost spoken word really, and 60s stuff. So, I do enjoy having hearing other poets read and really feeling that buzz of connection and being challenged.
Yes, I know when I've talked about poetry to people, and I've mentioned Roger McGough, and John Cooper Clarke, and that's what I and people are surprised when you tell them about that. They go, no, this is poetry here, and they go, what? Oh, wow, okay, they all think it's quills and sitting in a field with no shoes on and
Faber and Faber. That's right. Yes. That's true. I think John Cooper Clarke. I remember reading Enemy when I was, 15, 16, and he would always be in it. And I didn't quite understand him then, really, you know. But there he is. He's walked that walk. Fair play for him. And I think he's inspired a lot of other poets who perhaps wouldn't get up and probably comedians, actually, because he's very funny as well.
Very funny, yes.
Very acerbic.
Yeah.
Who makes you laugh? Sorry to ask you about it. Interesting.
I think Dave Allen was one.
Oh, right.
Dave Allen for me, because it was always, I think, because it was back then we only had, you had three channels.
Yeah.
And then I remember, we're old enough to remember when Channel 4 started, that's.
Yeah.
And it, I remember it used to be an event, and I could hear Mum and Dad talking about Dave Allen's on tonight. And then other mums and dads were, Dave Allen's on tonight. Because it wasn't on all the time. He'd have a special out or something like that. There'd be a special program.
Yeah.
And I was just intrigued. Who's this Dave Allen? Who is this? And then I remember watching him and just being drawn in by him. The fact that he sat there and didn't move. There weren't any gimmicks. He just sat there and told stories. Really, really hit me.
Yeah.
I thought that was incredible. Just by words alone.
Yeah.
Phenomenal. Yeah. Yeah.
That's interesting. That's going way back, isn't it? Really, yes.
And that got me going. Anyway, so Dave Allen. I never thought I'd be a comedian, though. That's the thing. I never planned this. I fell into it. I loved comedy. I could pull a pint. I ended up working at a comedy club. Yeah. And then 15 years later, I'm talking to you. And it's mad when I think about it.
So what was that trigger to get you actually up on stage then? Was it a...
Well,
open mic.
It was a friend of mine called Silky, who actually was one of the biggest comedy promoters in Wales, funnily enough.
All right.
So he was the one that he and I became mates, and then he booked me for his gigs in Oxford, and then he said, "Well, I've got loads more," and they were all around like Llanelli and
right.
So I've travelled Wales thanks to him.
And your stuff, Narberth.
Yeah.
All right, west.
Out to Narberth and Aberystwyth and my partner Jade, she's got, her best friend lives in Aberarr. Oh, her dad lives in Aberarr. Aberarr? It's up from Aberystwyth.
I can't think of that.
Aberaeron?
Aberaeron, maybe, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, that's very beautiful. Yeah, right.
It's right out there and... beautiful, just again. So that's why I think I connect Wales with my beginnings.
Right.
And
okay.
So I have a lot of love for Wales. And at the moment, but aren't you at the moment aren't you on lockdown at the minute, or is that just certain places?
No, certain places, but my county is one of the places. But then from Friday, the whole of Wales goes back into the fire break.
Oh.
I like how we changed it from circuit break to fire break, because it's ours. Oh, yes. Yeah. No messing.
I see a lot of, there's a friend of mine, Beth, and she's always talking about Welsh independence.
Yeah, and yeah. I'm a big advocate myself. People might think... it's funny because I've never thought myself as a nationalist, because I'm quite wary of nationalism. I think it can be quite exclusive and usually means racism and, you know, people who are not from that country out. But it feels within Wales that it's like an internationalist sense of independence, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
A real... well, that's the people I bother with. They have a real sense of inclusion and it's quite a socialistic approach, it feels, this sort of new... yearning for independence, which I think I'm so sick of Westminster, really.
Absolutely. Especially as them voting against feeding impoverished children. I mean, that's I have the words to say how I don't even. It's not even. It's beyond. It's not even beyond. It's not even sadness. It's not even despair. It's. There's no word for it.
And yet they can fund what is it, 7,000 a day for some consultant for the track and trace. 7,000 a day. You know. And
It's a disgrace. So I don't blame you for wanting independence.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting time, really, to look at. Yeah. These sort of issues and what sort of society do we want to live in, I suppose, and because that's another thing about, I think, it's shown up, hasn't it, the pandemic is society, you know, look, you look at America and it's such a messed up, fractured society, isn't it? It's quite frightening watching America actually implode in many ways. You know, like the infrastructure, and it just seems those countries have got a real sense of socialistic, you know, sense of supporting each other culture have seemed to held together better than the laissez-faire government, you know, the ultra-capitalist type of societies around the world, I think. So it's an interesting debate, isn't it? How do we want to live, I suppose we're saying, you know, how do we want to connect and what is the way to live?
But you'd think by now, I mean, these people are elected officials by us. They're supposed to represent us. And yet they're just taking from us, and they don't give a fuck about us. And it really, I can see why. I can see why people are just at the end of their tether. They're done. You know, you're not looking out for us, and we put you there. Yeah. So I tell you what, why don't you jog on? I completely get it.
Yeah,
it's sad.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
I know, but this is the thing, because it's so... I try, because because it bothers me so much. I try not to talk about it too much, but I can't help it. It just affects me. I really care about people. And which is why I do this. I want people to hear other people's stories. So then they go, oh, yeah, that, I think that, or I feel that way. And then people don't feel so alone.
Totally.
You know?
Yeah, I agree. One of my favourite quotes is by Arthur Miller, who said that he wrote his plays so people felt less alone, which is exactly what you're sort of saying. And, you know, for a great playwright like that, you know, of the 20th century, because it's a very simple statement, isn't it? But it's so true about art, connections, you know, comedy, really. There's nothing better than feeling in the room, because you do feel as if you all get that one joke or with an observation, and it's quite humanising, isn't it? You know, as well as poetry. A smaller group, usually put my poetry in, is about five people there, but that's okay.
Saying that, I did a show called Stand Up and Slam, and it was comedians versus poets in like a... like an 8 mile kind of stand thing. And then the audience would, we do rounds, and then the audience would vote who was the best comedy or poetry. And it was really good. And we used to get really, really good turnouts, really good audience numbers. People really up for it. And then there were people that were there for comedy, and then they get introduced to some brand new poets and spoken word. It introduced me to that whole world. I had no idea that there was this massive spoken word circuit.
Yeah.
It's huge.
That's a great collection of things, poets and comedians together. Could be a very entertaining, thought-provoking night. That could come back. We need it.
I hope it will. I'm sure it will.
Yeah,
it's a brilliant show, it made me realise that poetry and comedy are quite similar, because I used to take the piss and go, well, because it was all about slamming, so you'd be at each other. But then halfway through, I'd go, actually, I've got a lot of respect for the poets. I just want you to know that. You know, you'd always break it down. I'm, you know, taking the piss out and going, yeah, you're just using comedy to make your poetry more palatable. But but really, they're both very similar. They're both very similar.
It's that observation again, and, you know, deep sharing sometimes, you know, as well. A sharing, maybe, like I said, a comedian might make a joke about death or loss of his marriage, you know, through comedy, but it's actually quite poignant as well, isn't it? And then a poet perhaps will go a different direction, you know, usually, but you know, yeah, it's hard to pull off a funny poem, I find. It's very few. know, in all honesty, I try to think of funny poets. I mean, John Hegley, but again, he's got a sort of a strange, darker side underneath a lot of his poems too. And John Cooper Clarke, of course, you know, Beasley Street or Chicken Town.
Yes, John Hegley as well. My dad had John Hegley's books.
All right.
And I remember there was one, and it was about it was, I can't remember it word for word, but it was Dan's father has let him help with the fireworks. Dan's father has let him help with this. Then with the lighting of the fireworks. Dan is 35, and it really made me laugh. That, you know, you thought it was a little kid. It turns out it's a grown man. And I like that
observation.
Brilliant. What was it? Let's start. Oh, I'm going to ask you this. I don't want to spend too much time on it, but I have to ask. What's it been like watching your brother rise up to where he is? Like, that must have been quite surreal.
Yeah, it is. Obviously, he's my little brother as well. Yeah. So it's, to me, he's always that little scraggly kid who wants to play football when he's not quite good enough, but we would let him play, and you know, but also obviously seeing them, you know, start off, practicing in my dad's shed. I don't know how they did it, because it had electric in there, so it'd be a couple of amps in there, two drums. That's how they started, obviously, like all great bands, you know, The Clash, etc. You start in those garage lands, and I'm trying to think, really, obviously, they've been around a while now. So,
long time,
so
those days,
93 was their first album. So, God, that's, 92, sorry, 92, 92. So, just, you know, immense pride, really, because I know where they came from, and I know James really well, and Sean, and, you know, all they want to do is play music, write songs, and try to, speak about things that they cared about, and, you know, So, yeah, and to see my mum and dad very proud of him, you know, going along the way. And then, just a good sense. There's a slight downside being a writer of a famous person. Like, a lot of people sort of think that I'm just like some hanger-on, which so there's a slight albatross feel to having someone
yeah,
who
generally
wasn't in the band. Yeah, but there was. There is. And I get a lot of criticism. People say, oh, he's only writing, or he's only got a book out because he's Nicky Wise's brother. And it's like, well, you fucking try and get a book out, whatever. You know,
yeah, if you're not, yeah.
It doesn't matter whoever your brothers are and family. And I've worked with them, so of course.
Yeah.
Maybe I brought it on myself because I love working with particularly with James, because, you know, brothers, sometimes it's harder, isn't it, to work, you know, family. but I've done a lot of work with James because I love his artistry. I love his musicianship. And it's not because... I'm friends with James because he would tell me to fuck off if he didn't want to work with me, and he would, and he's many times he said, no, that's not a very good idea, or that's a rubbish poem, or, you know, he's great. So it's a mix and match, really, in all honesty.
Yeah.
But the deep down, I always think back to when they started, and that just the beautiful songs that they would craft, and the energy and the love for what they had and what they have for what they're doing, and I think that's. You know, it's not as if suddenly they live in big mansions and, you know, don't talk to their family type of thing. They're just good, solid, working class boys, really.
Yeah. Well, this is it. Yeah. And this is why I didn't, because this is about you. I wanted to talk to you. I just want to. And so this, you know, talking about your brother just briefly. But it's. Yeah, when they blew up, when they started, I was like, who the fuck is this? And you'd never seen anything like it, you know, not since the, you know, punk in the mid-70s, you know, it was like, holy shit. And then when you find out where they grew up, like you've said, you're like, they were wandering around like that in the valleys, they must be hard as fucking nails. Right?
Not really. But they just didn't care.
Yeah.
And they had each other. There's a strange gang mentality, isn't there? And then when Richie joined, obviously there was the four of them, and they had that sense of, I think it's invincibility, really, which a band gives you. You know, people like me and you, we're out by ourselves, aren't we, on that stage? There's no safety net. But, you know, it's like being in a marriage, a good marriage, I suppose, if you've got... or a very shit marriage if you're Noel Gallagher and Liam Gallagher. I think they stick up for each other. They're there for each other. Which helped them.
That goes back to you mentioned it earlier, that word, when we're talking about the male voice choirs, the dignity. And that is what the Manics have, or seem to have for me. Obviously dealing with the disappearance of Richie and not really knowing what's happened to him, but the way they handled that, and they must have been, all of you, it must have affected you all. But the way they handled it was just dignity. It's been beautiful.
Yeah, no, I agree totally. I think that the way just handling that, because it could have, you know, they could have fueled rumours, they could have spoke about it, you know, or been very emotional about it. Obviously they were, but they just kept it, I think, together. And I think you're right. Yeah. That's the best dignified response to it, really. All these years later, even, it's still you're right.
That dignity.
And never got anyone else to replace him as well, which I think is always, that's a really, you know, strong statement, isn't it? You know, of course they've had session musicians to play, but never, do you know what I mean? It's not like Whitesnake or someone like that.
No,
so it's a terrible comparison.
I know what you mean, though. I know what you mean.
Or different bands, you can't keep up with their members, you know.
Yeah.
He's funny. He still drives me mad with his little nickisms, obviously, you know, and I drive him mad with my older brother, you know, sort of ways as well. But it's, you know, we always have a laugh about things, and we always, that's how we've got over losing our parents, I think, by smiling about those lovely moments of and funny times and, you know, things that, I, of course, I'm immensely proud of, you know, he's my little brother. He's out there making songs.
Beautiful. And you're out there doing your own stuff. Are you working on stuff now?
Yeah, always got different projects underway. I had a play in 2016, which is a really one of my proudest things that I worked on, I suppose. I say proudest. Pride is the wrong word, I suppose. you know, a belief in it. It was about a choir where everyone was living with dementia, which was based on a real choir in Merthyr. And now, you know, there's a lot of choirs where people are living with dementia and sing and share. It's breathtaking. And it was called Before I Leave. And so I'm sort of working on that, adapting as a film, really. I think there's a story there, yeah, about, again, people coming together and the power of song, like we talk about our conversation, music. Because, yeah, again, moved to tears. I remember I was sat in this, it was pissing down with rain, Tuesday afternoon in Merthyr Tydfil. You've probably been to Merthyr. It's
been
pretty
Merthyr,
great.
Yeah.
And it was in the rugby club. And I was there to do a writing workshop with the choir. But it didn't, you know, people really weren't into writing and they wanted to talk, which is fine. So I sat in the back and I thought I'd just have a listen. The first time I've ever really been in a choir where people were living with dementia. And I just sat at the back and it was, what song was it? It was Take Me Home Country Roads, you know, John Denver, beautiful. And all of a sudden, everyone in the room just knew every single word and was singing. Oh, it gives me goose pimples now. And so from that moment on, I thought there's a story here. This is powerful, it's, you know. So yeah, I'm working on that really, which is quite a sort of a, it's a lot. I don't know the world of film. I just know I can, I would love to tell that story again. So doing that and always writing poetry. And but yes, it's, I don't know, probably even harder being a comedian because you literally can't really do stand-up, can you?
Bits and bobs.
Yeah? Do you do online stuff, performances?
Oh, yeah, but it's really difficult to try and make a laptop laugh. Yeah, it's all right if you can hear people responding, but I actually did one of the last outdoor gigs I did was in just outside Cardiff, actually. It was in there's a golf course, golf club just outside of Cardiff.
Right.
That I did for Vix Leighton. I can't remember what it's called, but it's a nice place, big old place. But yeah, that was one of the last ones I did outside. But other than that, yeah, bits and pieces, but not much. But
do you miss it?
I do.
Yeah.
Talking to comedians, I was talking to Rosie Jones the other day, and she was saying, like, we miss the green room as well as the gig. Like, you know, when you're seeing there's people that you haven't seen for ages. Like Rosie and I haven't seen each other for a long time, and it was just nice to see each other. And I suppose, it's the community, it's the, you know, hooking up. And I miss that. But I'm sure we'll get back to it. This is only temporary.
And do you find are you writing a lot of material, or have you gone a bit apathetic, or do you find yourself fueled by everything? Or
I actually feel fueled, actually. Great. I did a gig the other night and I didn't know what I was going to say. Whereas before I'd be panicking, going, right, I just went out and just started talking.
Wow.
And just started talking about the fact that I don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
And everyone went, yeah, neither do I. And we had this real moment where none of us know what's going on. It was a really nice thing. So, yeah, I almost feel like it doesn't matter. I can just go out and talk.
Yeah.
And I enjoy that.
That's interesting. Yeah.
And then, doing this as well, I get to meet amazing people like yourself, Patrick. And
that's very kind.
This has been an absolute joy to have you on. I hope you've enjoyed
it's
it.
Flown and, by. Yeah.
Yeah, you see. You. It's nice and easy. I'm not Paxman. I'm not here to probe. We're just here to have a chat.
Do you want a poem?
Yes.
Or not?
Yes, I do. Come on.
Oh, okay. Oh shit. I was half okay. I have got one. Sort of angry political one or somewhat. So we say, you know, positive, holistic, coming together. You choose.
Oh, wow.
Which one?
Shall we do holistic coming together?
Yeah, okay. That's fine. It's called Bring It Back Home. Starts off with a quote by Rumi. I don't know if you've come across Rumi. You probably have. You know, he always crops up on Facebook and Twitter. The 12th century, I think. Fucking hell. He's, you know, it's amazing. Quick little aside, I once had a review of my first book in 1995, I think it was, and it was in I think it was in the NME, which was quite exciting to have a little book review, obviously. But there's a caveat to that. All it said was great quotes, shit poetry. That was it. So because I love my quotes, so I had a lot of quotes in this little booklet. Anyway, sorry. Bring it back home. Rumi, if you are irritated by every rub, how will you ever be polished? Beautiful. Rumi. Where there is bile, return to lullaby. When they are fists, hold fast to flowers. When they throw you chains, knit a shawl. If it rains tongues of nails, become a hammer. When they staple our mouths shut, strum guitars. When they ask for selfishness, stand in solidarity. When they scream for death, scatter sunflower seeds. If they bring starvation, make a soup from your memories. As they sell you perfection, make a crack. When they build walls, design doors. When they preach paradise, close the door. It is here inside. And as they bellow me, 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 whisper goldenly, we, we. That's the poem. There we are. Bring it back home. It's a poem of hope. Thank you.
Oh, mate, that was incredible.
Patrick,
thank you so much, man.
Thank you, Rich. Oh, it's been lovely chatting.
Oh, it's been lovely chatting to you, man. That was a beautiful way to finish. I am genuinely moved. Oh, my God.
Thank you.
Thank you, mate. Where can we find your stuff?
Good question, really. Yeah. I've got a website, obviously. You know, that sort of thing. I could email that to Paul, website.
Yes, please. Yes.
You know, I follow you on Twitter now. I think we follow each other, so yes, it's good to keep in touch.
Lovely.
And it's mostly a website, I suppose, and just ranting on Twitter. But
Patrick,
let me just chat. You're a good man, and my 27-year-old son, he loves his comedy, so I sent him some links to your stand-up as well.
Oh, bless you. Thank you.
Take care.
When this is done, you and I, we will meet and we will have a cup of tea.
Lovely. In Glengarry.
In Glengarry. I'll come to Glengarry. It'd be good to see the place again.
Thanks, Richie. Take care, and thanks very much for having me.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Made by darkhorsedigital.co.uk. Shooting, live streaming, and podcast production.